then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's February the 20th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, we begin this week with an internal note. Most of you will already have noticed that on Sunday, February the 16th, I uploaded a 40-minute shortcast to the northwestfront.org website entitled A Short Introduction to the Northwest Front. Now, this is a brief audio introduction to the NF meant to be sent out to people who contact us as part of their introductory packet. I need all you guys who are making CD copies of Radio Free Northwest to make as many copies of this one as you can and send them to me. I will not only send them out in intros, but I'll pass them along to other active people who request them in turn to give to prospects. And by the way, that's one of the comments in the 5th edition White Book. Every one of you out there needs to be working at least two or three new prospective party supporters on an individual basis. This short introduction was frankly designed for muggles, so-called normal people, insofar as any normality remains in the society, who have had minimal contact with the party or with organized white nationalism. Now, I admit it's kind of a patchwork of several other shortcasts I've done, specifically Why I Say Nigger and HAC Speaks to Conservatives, but again, bearing in mind the target audience, I think it's best to immediately leap in and address two issues which will probably be of more concern to your average muggle than some long esoteric rant about the Federal Reserve or 9/11 truth or anything like that. Now, the first is my use of language and forbidden words, and that's an important hurdle to clear. You would be amazed at how many average white people now believe that it is actually illegal to say the word nigger, and they need to understand what the dictatorship is doing to their minds and why. Also, your average first contactee will probably consider himself to be a conservative, and he'll immediately notice some things about the NF that Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck will have told him are wicked and evil, and we need to grab hold of that issue by the horns and bulldog it immediately. This audio presentation is designed to pique the interest and the curiosity of your average, everyday paleface, and to get him or her to want to know more. It is meant to lure him or her to those big, thick books with no pictures that our people have to start reading in order to understand. It needs to be one of the first things that a newbie hears, and that's why I need you guys' help in manufacturing as many of these CDs as possible. Now, I can burn them off one by one on my computer, but that's way too slow and time-consuming. Okay, second internal note. I just got a notification from the post office that I have a package waiting for me downtown, so in just a bit, I'm going to nip out and collect that package, which I am reasonably sure is the second printed test copy of the 5th edition Party Manual, the White Book. In order to save Boku coin, we are using a self-publishing service that just gives us the bare bones and doesn't include things like assistance with formatting and layout. And what that means is that I have to upload onto their template, diddle with it until I think it looks right, and then order and pay for a sample printed copy to see if it is right. And this is what's taking so long with the book, because again, in order to save some shekels, I can't order express mailing at $20 a pop. So after every new upload, it takes about a week to get a physical copy into my hand and see if I was able to figure out the software properly this time, given my antediluvian computer skills. Now, this is why we need a professional headquarters staff. White people with skill sets who will devote their entire time to the Northwest Republic for about $1 a year. Mostly young white people who are willing to voluntarily renounce the wealth and the pleasures and the glittering baubles of consumer America. Although that's probably not going to be as hard as it used to be because, let's face it, I think young white people these days, especially boys, are already well aware that America has nothing for them, but we're going to need young people who are willing to sleep on mattresses on the floor and dress out of the local Goodwill store just like I do, and who are willing to devote every waking moment and every jot of skill and talent and energy they possess to the Northwest American Republic. I shouldn't have to mess with online self-publishing at all. We should have a full-time party publications department working in an actual for real office. A department that is capable of producing everything from a leaflet to a full-length book, on premises, except for the actual printing. And doing a slap-up professional job of it at that. No one in what little remains of the white nationalist movement has anything like that anymore. Now, when you hear me accused of having an edifice complex and being obsessed with buildings and outward appearances, this is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about party professionalization. I repeat that when I first came into this movement in 1972, everybody and his dog had a building, Klan, Nazi, what have you, even if it was only a little storefront someplace. To my knowledge, no white nationalist organization in this country has a building anymore, unless you want to count Willis Cardo's assorted enterprises as white nationalist, which, it's kind of a fine line there. And I think even he just rents office space, because Cardo is just about the last among us with any money. Now, at some point, we have to get this Northwest independence movement off the kitchen table. Please bear that in mind in the coming months when I'm begging you for the resources to do that. And no, this isn't a fund appeal. Now's not the time, with almost half of North America frozen over and millions of people without power. You've got other things to worry about now. But at some point in the not-too-distant future, sometime in the spring when the weather clears up and you can think, you and me are going to have to sit down and figure out where we're going and how we're going to get there. The fifth edition white book discusses these things to the extent where it's advisable to do so in public. Tell you what, speaking of the white book, I'm going to take a break right now and go down to the post office and see if we've got a presentable hard copy yet. Back in a bit. In the meantime, here's Lord Lucan.
There is no such thing as a public speaking dictatorship. You can listen to a public speaker, or you can ignore his speech. If a public speaker tells the public what they want to hear, he will be called a demigod. Mussolini was called a demigod by saying what the public wants to hear and appealing to the majority. Democracy means rule by the majority. The American press in particular opposes majority rule and hence opposes democracy, because the American press is ruled by a minority. Jews. Jews are bankers and tribalists who will put the interests of themselves ahead of their own nation and consequently make themselves the enemy of nationalists. That America fights wars for the benefit of democracy is, of course, the big lie. For example, Hitler was elected by the majority. In Austria, he had a 98% support from the Austrians. The movie The Sound of Music was strictly Hollywood. In a dictatorship, the administration rules by the threat of violence. Mugabe is a dictator. He has built a palace for himself, whereas the population he rules over must vote for him or get their asses beaten up. The British government gave £2 million to South Africa, so what does the president of South Africa do with the money? He builds himself a palace. The people of South Africa get nothing. In Malawi, an African country next door to Zimbabwe, one of their politicians has stolen $2 billion in the coin of their realm. But that is to be expected. Cronyism is the name of the game when it comes to the blacks. Dictatorship is what you get in a black African country. Obama is turning America into a dictatorship, just like any black African country. Now, in the British system, if the Prime Minister's popularity drops below 50%, Parliament can have a vote of no confidence. If the Prime Minister loses the vote, it forces a general election. Now, Obama's popularity has dropped below 50%. Therefore, under the British system, he would be out of office. There is a rumor that Obama is seeking to make himself life president, just like they do in so-called democracies in Africa. There is also a rumor that martial law will come to America. According to an economist, Porter Sainsbury, Congress will pass legislation that will enable the government to steal people's savings in their bank accounts and in their pension funds on July 1st. Why? Because this is what they are doing to the pension funds in Detroit. You get the government that you deserve. The white people who voted for Obama were not racially aware, but Obama has done a great job of waking such people up. Race is not just skin deep. The poverty of Africa is the result of the moral bankruptcy of the blacks. You need also to rethink the Protestant work ethic. 85% of Malawi is Presbyterian after Dr. Livingstone, but the government is corrupt. Freedom is a white ideal. Lower evolved life forms all live under tyrants. It is the natural condition of minorities to live under tyrants. The Magna Carta was the work of white people. As more minorities outnumber white people, you will see the disappearance of the Fourth Amendment and freedom. On Sunday, a whistleblower in the NSA by the name of Tom Drake is blowing the whistle on the complete disappearance of the right to privacy, the right to counsel, of indefinite detention without a trial, etc., etc. Secrecy is hated in a government for the people by the people. In fact, in a democracy, the government has to disclose where it is spending taxpayers' money. Otherwise, you have taxation without representation. Trillions, yes, trillions of dollars have been spent on projects without any oversight whatsoever. They call it the black budget. Lower evolved life forms decide their leaders through violence and brute force. However, the white man wishes to be more evolved, and therefore leadership has to be decided by more intelligent means. Democracy asks the people to make intelligent choices as to the leadership question. Lower evolved life forms will choose the biggest bully, such as, say, Mugabe, and then wonder why they live under a tyrant. Unfortunately, Americans are no more intelligent than blacks of Zimbabwe. The only thing in America that prevents America from becoming a tyranny like Zimbabwe is a piece of paper known as the Constitution. The Constitution is as useless as the Edict of Nantes, an edict written on a piece of paper by a king of France. On St. Bartholomew's Day, the edict was revoked. Every American should read the history of Protestantism to fully understand how useless it is to rely on a piece of paper, such as the Constitution, to defend freedom. Americans make their choices as to who they elect by listening to the mainstream media and by listening to the political ads of the candidate, instead of reading the voter's pamphlet or listening to the party's manifesto or even the political speeches of the candidate. Decisions are even made on what sort of tie the candidate is wearing. Jesus said it is easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. But America, a so-called Christian nation, elects the rich guy. Or in England's case, the aristocrat Winston Churchill. Sir Oswald Mosley, who knew Churchill, says in My Life by Sir Oswald Mosley that Churchill was an asshole. The rich and the aristocracy consider the ordinary people, or we the people, the same way as the Jews consider we the people, as cattle or trailer trash. So you vote for candidates who consider you to be cattle. Then you wonder why your jobs have been exported to China or some other foreign country. Jesus said of the Jews, offspring of vipers, but you elected people, such as the rich, who have exactly the same opinion of the people as the Jews, to represent you. You elect the rich, whose only consideration is themselves, and who will say anything to get elected. You consider pastors to be successful only if they make a ton of money. The good book says that money is the root of all evil, yet you consider yourselves to be Christian. On the other hand, Germany did something completely radical. They elected someone from the lowest social class, a former unemployed Vienna street artist. Now, instead of serving himself and building a palace like Mugabe, he used the taxpayers' money to build the Autobahn. He put an end to German unemployment. A politician that serves his people instead of himself could not be tolerated in conservative circles. Such a leader has to be defeated. If he cannot be defeated at the polls, then he has to be defeated by war. So some excuse to start a war with Germany has to be found by the conservatives. The Labour Party of England had been defeated at the election because of a self-serving leader who listened to a certain Lady Londonderry and started what became known as below-the-deck strike. If the Labour Party is going to serve only the interests of the rich and the upper class, such as Lady Londonderry, then there is no difference between them. But the Germans had elected someone who never forgot that he was a commoner. So the commoners had to be persuaded to fight against their own kind. They had to be brainwashed to go to war against the National Socialist German Labour Party. The leader of a peace movement, who had travelled to Germany, said, "If you cannot love Hitler, then you cannot love anyone." Not enough working class people engaged in the civil disobedience are refusing to be enlisted, except the pacifist and British Union. War is politics by other means. World War II was a class war. The self-serving conservatives on the one side and an unemployed Vienna street artist on the other. But whose side did America support? We supported the Tories, the political party that we fought the revolution against. In 1952, Queen Elizabeth rode in a horse-drawn, 4-ton gold coach to be crowned as Queen of England. It was built by George III. And whose tax money was used to build that coach? American tax money from the 18th century. Conservative in England means being a Tory. It means supporting the aristocracy, the rich, and oppressing the poor. In America, being conservative means defending the Constitution and freedom. The Founding Fathers were the enemy of the Tories. When England fought the Battle of Trafalgar, the Navy recruited by means of press gangs and used a whip known as the Cat of Nine Tails. On the French side was the idea of a republican form of government, a government by the people. We Americans supported the French. We bought Louisiana, and that money was spent on the French Navy. But when it came to World War II, we supported the Tories, because America has forgotten its revolution. America has become a Tory country. Queen Victoria fought not one, but two opium wars against China, and that is how the Tories made their money. And America is no different. The CIA makes its money by means of the global drug trade. Our foreign policy is 100% Tory. We only support other narco states. Our transport aircraft are not subject to customs inspections, and that is how the heroin from Afghanistan is flown into America and England. The Taliban outlawed the production of opium in 2001, and that is the real reason we're in Afghanistan. Prince Bandar is the acting king of Saudi Arabia. The king is in a coma. He was the real brains behind 9/11, but in Toryism, the rich are above the law. The people that committed the murder of 3,000 Americans on 9/11 will never come to trial, because America is a Tory country. The super-rich, such as Prince Bandar and George Bush, are above the law. The bankers are super-rich, they were bailed out, and will not be prosecuted, because in a Tory government, the super-rich are above the law. Equal under law? Hey, America, wake up and stop being clueless. Now let me change the subject. I need an engineer to help me make the Hendershot fuel-less generator. If we can make these generators, we should be able to make some real money. This generator runs off the Earth's magnetic field. It was first invented back in 1928. Thank you.
Comrades, tonight I would like to say a few words about Parvataka Acharya and his new book, Living Dharma. Now, this is a wonderful accompaniment to Ara Dharma, which is a book I talked about a few months back. Of course, that was the book that explains the notion of dharmic face and also declares Hitler as a chakravartin, and that's somebody, of course, who embodies both the principles of the Brahmin and also the Kshatriya, and how the National Socialist ideology is an expression of the politics of Dharma. Now, what living Dharma really does, especially, is it clarifies this contradiction between ahimsa and the defense of Dharma. So, in other words, harmlessness, but also the ability to defend Dharma. So, it's really a very nice book. It's a pocket-sized book. And that's something that you can look up on the Parvataka Archeraji's website. And that website is Dharma Central. So, because I only have a few words to say about that book, it's really a very quick read, and it has a lot of sayings that you can meditate on. I'd also like to go into my observations about the Tea Party. Now, I've been somewhat of two minds about this idea, and so I discussed this with a friend of mine, and he feels that there is some interest in racial issues in the Tea Party, but of course they're very timid. I do know a couple of people that I would say are likely sympathetic to the Tea Party, but they're both very geriatric. Of course, the Tea Party does skew quite elderly, even more so than we skew that way. And nevertheless, I do often find it interesting to observe other races, and I do find that blacks in particular have a lot of contempt for the Tea Party, but I think they also have a fear of the Tea Party. Now, recently I was listening to C-SPAN, and I was watching a black lecturer who was talking about the Tea Party and talking about a study that had been done on the Tea Party versus conservatives. Now, the idea of conservatism is rather interesting because, as I was saying last week when I reviewed that book about Hitler, Hitler was not a fiscal conservative, although he may have been a social conservative. So the term conservative for our movement, I think, is always rather odd. But at any rate, this lecturer was discussing the Tea Party and saying they're really different from conservatives. The culmination of his lecture was this question of whether or not the Tea Party is patriotic. And even though the Tea Partiers say that they're very patriotic, this lecturer felt that the Tea Party was really not patriotic because they did not want to support public school. Now, I understand Tea Partiers not wanting to support public school because they're spending a lot of their hard-earned money on students that really have no interest in school or no aptitude for school, and therefore they're fed up with that. That's understandable. So the question, though, really is whether or not people who conceive of themselves as Tea Party patriots would really want to make the leap to work with a group such as ours. And I have to say I'm a bit of a skeptic regarding that, and I know that it's been tried by other groups, and I don't see as anything has come of it. But I'm not against trying this idea because I don't really see the harm in trying it as long as excessive energy is not directed towards something that may not pan out. Now, of course, the other group that is in the Northwest and that skews much younger and also has an ideal of Northwest independence is the Cascadia group. But they're clearly an extremely liberal group. And they're very environmental, which I see no reason why we can't take an interest in environmentalism. I don't see anything contradictory in that. I have to say, I feel the need to be fluid on all of these concepts because, of course, I don't know how this is all going to play out in the next several years and next decade or so. So I have to remain rather open and rather non-committal, as I think we all need to. We need to try various things and realize that, you know, it's uncertain that they'll necessarily work. I'm sorry I don't have a more definite opinion at this time, but this is really the best I can do on this subject. So thank you for listening. Thank you.
Okay, got the white book, and while it is a vast improvement over the first test copy, there are still some glitches in the formatting that, in my opinion, are not acceptable and make it impossible for me to release it yet. So it will be another couple of weeks before the actual book itself is available, for which I apologize. But the alternative was to pay $1,000 to this outfit for some gook in Hong Kong or some wog in Mumbai or wherever the hell these people farm out their work to do something that I myself can probably figure out how to do if I just keep on dealing with it. What I can and will do now is release the PDF copy of the 5th edition of the manual so you can read it on your computer, and if you want a hard copy, you can print one out for yourself. Let me know at nwnet@earthlink.net if you want one of these PDFs. Here's a little number from back in the days when older generations knew how to deal with race mixing. This is the Blasters.
Hangs like a dead man from a white oak tree. People sitting on porches thinking how things used to be. Dark night, it's a dark night. Dark night, it's a dark night. Neighborhood was changing, strangers moving in. A new boy fell for a local girl when she made eyes at him. She was young and pretty, no stranger to other men. But windows were being locked at night and whole lines drawn again. Thought these things didn't matter anymore. I thought all that blood had been shed long ago. Dark night, it's a dark night. He took her to the outskirts. Pledged his love to her. He thought it was their secret, but someone knew where they were. He held her so close. He asked about her dreams. When a bullet from a passing car made the young girl scream. I thought these things didn't happen anymore. All that blood had been shed long ago. Dark night, it's a dark night. Dark night, it's a dark night. Dark night.
Another couple of quick housekeeping notes before I go on with the main part of the podcast. As you know, we have three or four regular contributors on here besides myself, Gretchen, Olivia, Andy, Lord Lucan, etc. And for whatever reason, in the past year or so, audio contributions from you guys in the audience have dropped off, possibly because I simply haven't been asking for them, and that's my mistake. And so once again, I want to ask all you listeners out there to speak up and let your voices be heard on this program. Please send me your spoken MP3 files, either directly by attachment or through sendspace.com or some other FTP site. And so long as they're basically coherent and the audio can be cleaned up with WavePad if necessary so people can understand you, I'll put you on Radio Free Northwest. Hey, you can talk about any racial or political topic you want, so long as it's not too far out in left field. I kind of tend to draw the line at Atlantis and flying saucers. But other than that, feel free. Migrants to the homeland are especially encouraged to share some of their migration experiences with the audience. It's important that people listening to this program understand that the Northwest Front is not just a one-man band. They need to hear other voices besides mine, literally. And that's why I need to hear from you guys. We all need to hear from you guys via your MP3 files. Lay them on me. Secondly, I want to try and revive the Colonel House Academy of the Cinematic Arts that we started a couple of years ago for aspiring Northwest YouTube video producers and other video efforts. Now, as is usual in our wee little movement, there was an initial burst of enthusiasm. We had over a dozen people signing on and vowing and swearing that we were going to conquer YouTube through their efforts. And then when it came time to stop chattering about it on the internet and start putting in those long hours behind the computer screen, editing and filtering and doing all that complicated stuff that takes up so much time, these people basically went dark and wandered away. Story of our movement. Now, right now, there is one man who still does YouTubes for us on an occasional basis. His videos are damn good, but they just get fewer and farther between as time goes by. Now, could we possibly revive the Colonel House Academy and see if maybe some more of us can stick with it this time? One of the things I mentioned in my short introduction is that the NF has a problem. We rely too much on somehow persuading white Americans to sit down and read a series of big, thick books, because the information they need to know is contained in those books. We need to get into videos, a lot of videos, enough videos so that they can never all be chased off YouTube, because there's simply too many of them. And eventually, we need to produce that ultimate in the American communications experience, the quote-unquote graphic novel, which is another way of saying comic books for adults who can no longer read blocks of text for content. But there's also room for other genres like poster art, you name it. Now, I know that a lot of you guys out there can draw and use Photoshop. Now, some of the items that you have produced for the NF are really superb, and I'd love it if we could get you guys an audience for your work of more than a few hundred people. Guys, I need to see individual initiative on this and in almost everything else. I'm not one of these fearless leaders who wants to micromanage everything and make sure that everything is uniform and centralized. I can't do that, and the movement as a whole can't do that because it's the wrong tactic under present circumstances. I need your help, but not just your skills. I need your commitment, so that when you start in on something for the Northwest Front, you will follow it through and finish the job. Anyway, enough of that. I've gotten a few requests that I elucidate on the GOP entryism thing as to exactly what I mean, how exactly it would work, so forth and so on. First, as is so often the case in anything to do with our wee little subculture, before I can explain what I mean, I must first sit down and explain carefully and in great detail what I do not mean, since, as per usual, some of us have been leaping and bounding like kangaroos to the wrong conclusions. Now that's okay, this is the movement and I'm used to it. I say again, many if not most of you guys out there will someday be future leaders in the Northwest Independence Movement and you are going to have to do this on your own without me. So remember that little tip. On any topic with white nationalists of any stripe, it is just as important and just as urgent to explain what you do not mean as it is to explain what you mean. Because if you're talking to 50 people, you're going to get maybe 10 correct understandings and about 40 misconceptions and kangaroo-like leaps and bounds to incorrect conclusions as to what you're talking about, which will sometimes be the complete reverse of what you're trying to convey. Now, this is just another part of us being who we are, what the Jews have made us. And it's an aspect of trying to work with white people that you're going to have to learn to deal with. Now, this is why spaced repetition is important. I know how this sounds, and it doesn't sound very nice. But the time and place we live in isn't very nice. I am for real trying to teach you guys and somehow instill in you some of my 42 years of experience in dealing with our own people. Okay, moving right along here. What I am not talking about here is quote-unquote taking over the Republican Party. I am not talking about running for political office as Republicans and taking over Congress or the state legislature or anything like that. I'm not talking about the system dragging us in. Now, are we clear on that? We're talking about an organization run by a small clique of Jews and billionaires who are some of the most ruthless men in the world. That would never be allowed, and we shouldn't waste time on it. What I am talking about is what the mob would refer to as wetting our beak. I'm talking about getting close enough to cherry-pick some of the many, many desperate white people who will be rushing to the Republicans as part of the 2014 and 2016 elections because they've been taught all our lives that that is their only alternative. You need to circle the Republican Party like sharks and pick off the ones who are susceptible to what the dictatorship has come to refer to as radicalization. And by the way, radicalization is well on its way to becoming a criminal offense in itself now. In fact, it already is in the UK. You can get your website pulled down if it allegedly promotes radicalization of youth, either Muslim or white. I tell you what, you're Americans, I'm an American, and like all Americans, we get most of our socialization from television and movies. Some of you will have seen the 1965 movie Dr. Zhivago. It's about the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 and the Russian Civil War of the 1920s. Great flick, and if you haven't seen it, I heartily recommend it. Here's a brief sound clip from that movie, and yes, 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 I know it's talking about communists. Just remember, communists usually win their revolutions.
Bourgeois terms, it was a war between the Allies and Germany. In Bolshevik terms, it was a war between the Allied and German upper classes. And which of them won was a matter of indifference. I was ordered by the party to enlist. I gave my name as Petrov. They were shouting for victory all over Europe, praying for victory to the same God. My task, the party's task, was to organize defeat. From defeat would spring the revolution, and the revolution would be victory for us. When the time came, I was able to take three battalions with me out of the front line, the best day's work I ever did. But for the moment, there was nothing to be done. There were too many volunteers, like me. Mostly, it was mere hysteria.
Now, let's say that you decide you're tired of sitting behind your computer, and you've got the gotta-do-something bug. Gotta-do-something! Now, that's quite common, and it's actually commendable, and it's what we're after. If there is to be any hope for our racial survival, you do indeed gotta-do-something. The trick is to get you to do the right thing and not waste yet more time in the same old dead ends. Now, usually when our movement people get the gotta-do-something bug, what they come up with involves standing out on a street corner somewhere, wearing some strange garb or maybe not, and holding a sign, and getting their names in the police databases if they're not already there, along with five or six other people. 20 years ago, it would have been 30 or 40 other people. 10 years ago, it would have been 18 or 20 people. Now it's usually down to about 5 or 6, since everybody else has fled onto the nice, safe internet. Or so they think. Turns out the internet itself is no longer so safe. People are now being arrested for what they post on the internet. Ask Bill White. Ask that poor, wretched kid in Texas, Justin Carter, who was thrown in jail and raped by niggers for a Facebook post. Ask Roger Shuler, who's listed by the New York Times as the only officially recognized politically imprisoned journalist in America. He was arrested without a warrant, and he's been held in prison in Alabama without bail and without charge since October for refusing to take down a blog post. And God knows how many other cases we haven't even heard of. Sorry, I'm rambling again. Where was I? Okay, you're a white nationalist and you got a bad case of the gotta do somethings. Now, what can we have you do that gets you out from behind that computer screen, gets you out into the real world, meeting and interacting with real live human beings, and which serves an actual purpose in that it results in our ideas reaching people beyond our own tiny little circle? First off, a caveat. If you have any kind of traceable racial past, don't try this. When the country club types who run your local Republican chapter find out about it, they will run you off, to the point of calling the police or having some apes from the local college football team physically drag you out of the meeting room, which has happened before. They will issue press releases denouncing you and wicked racism in general. There is nothing that so terrifies the Republican establishment than any association with overt white nationalism, and they will go to any extreme to avoid it. Now, what this means, effectively, is that if you have ever worn a costume, or streetwalked, or held up a sign in public, you probably shouldn't try this, because you won't be able to pull it off. You are on the police databases, and you will eventually be found out. There have been cases where certain Republican chapters in the South have handed over their own mailing lists, and in some cases lists of registered Republican voters in their districts, to people like the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center, so those lists can be screened and matched with their databases, and so-called racists and extremists identified and purged from any Republican committees or groups they may belong to. Now, this is where keeping your head down and staying out of the enemy databases will pay off. Once you finally find within yourself the courage to step out from behind the computer at all. Now, when that day comes, it means that you have no need to put on a costume or run around in the street waving a sign with five or six other guys and get your name in the police databases where it never was before. You can maintain your nice, safe respectability, insofar as Republicans are respectable these days, although the way the media is going at them hammer and tongs, it's actually becoming not so respectable anymore to be associated with the Republican Party. After all, that indicates that you're mean and cruel and racist and sexist and homophobic and waging a war on women and blah, 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 blah. Now, do you begin to see where I've been going with this? Okay, music break. Let's see here. What have I got lying around on my hard drive? Tell you what, it's been donkey's years since I've had any classical music on here, so here's the opening from Mars, Bringer of War, from Gustav Holst's The Planets Suite. Right, it's now 3:35 p.m., and once again, something has come up that only I can deal with, which yet again points out the need for a professionalized party, but I won't get into that. As I mentioned earlier in this podcast, I have one more book I've got to get published, which has been a real bear to wrestle with. And it looks like I'll have to wrestle with it still more for a few weeks. But from that point on, I'll at least be able to devote all of my time to what I refer to in my own mind as the people stuff. When that time comes, I'm going to have a lot to say on the subject of professionalization. I debated whether to just go ahead and hold the rest of this podcast over until tomorrow, but I decided no. I'll shoot for upload tonight, as always. This does mean, however, that I need to speed things along a bit, and so instead of doing the last two sections ad lib with further exposition on Republican entryism, I'm going to need a ready-made script. I get frequent questions about Rhodesia, where I lived from 1973 until 1976, with an 8-month stint in South Africa as well. So I'm going to tell you the story of the Shangani Patrol, which has sometimes been called the Custer's Last Stand of Africa. This is from my Weird Aryan History series. The small white nation of Rhodesia was founded in 1890 by the Pioneer Column, which marched across country from South Africa and erected a fort at what later became the city of Salisbury. By 1893, the new colony, at first called Mashonaland, was elbowing the territory of the warlike Matabele tribe, an offshoot of the Zulus, who used the same tribal military system of impis or regiments as the Zulus. In October of 1893, at the beginning of the rainy season, war broke out between the white settlers and the Matabele. The settlers, commanded by Cecil Rhodes's associate Dr. Leander Starr Jameson, marched into Matabele land and quickly burned Matabele King Lobengula's kraal, or village, up on a flat-topped mountain called Tabasinduna. Lobengula himself fled into the bush with his warriors, and the English determined to pursue him. Up until that point, the whites, who were armed with modern rifles, Maxim machine guns, and a few light artillery pieces, had easily defeated the blacks, who had only spears. But at this point, for reasons that have never been fully explained, the whole campaign went to hell in a handbasket. To begin with, it was the worst time of year for such a campaign in what's known as the low veld in Rhodesia. Tsetse fly country, deadly for horses. The rains had broken, malaria would soon be rampant, and the waterlogged veld would make progress difficult. In addition, the infernal dissension, which is the curse of our race, had manifested itself, and there was quarreling and intrigue and division among the officers of the Rhodesian forces. On November the 9th, 1893, Jameson decided to send a strong patrol to reconnoiter the country between Inyati and Shiloh, and, if possible, bring Lobengula back a prisoner. His call for volunteers met with a good response, and the force of 320 men was composed of volunteers from the Salisbury and Victoria Columns and 150 men of the Bechuanaland Border Police and RAF's Rangers, who had reached Bulawayo ahead of the main body of the Southern Column. With 3 Maxim machine guns and 200 native carriers, and with Major Forbes in command, they rode out of Bulawayo shortly before sunset on November the 14th. The first 2 days and nights it rained almost continually, and the horses, which were in poor condition after the main campaign, found the sodden country heavy going. Forbes made for the London Missionary Society's station at Inyati, which had been established before the days of Thomas Baines, and found it a sorry sight. Its normal occupants had abandoned it at the beginning of the invasion, and it was now occupied by a party of Matabele in charge of a large herd of cattle. They fled. The Matabele had vented their wrath on the missionaries' houses, which had been wrecked in an orgy of destruction. The veld was littered with torn books, broken furniture, and ruined personal belongings. Leaving a force of 80 men to garrison the station, Forbes went on with the remainder. This part of the country had been heavily populated, and in the numerous kraals they found cattle and grain. The grain was a welcome addition to their meager diet. The force had left Bulawayo before the arrival of the main southern column with its food supplies, and their rations, small enough when they started on the pursuit, were by now almost exhausted. They had kept going with what they could find in Matabele corn bins, but now this source was almost at an end. When they reached the last of the kraals and realized that the further they went, the shorter they would be of food, many of the men became discontented. They considered that the pursuit should be postponed until the food position was corrected, and did not see why they should have to endure hardships that could be avoided. Major Forbes saw their point of view, but knew that if they gave up the chase now, they would never overtake Lobengula. He paraded his force and ordered the malcontents to step forward. Most of Rauf's Rangers and the Salisbury Horse did so, but the Victoria Column stood firm. The detachment of Bechuanaland Border Police, being regular soldiers, were not consulted. Forbes thereupon sent a messenger to Bulawayo asking for food and instructions, and received a reply from Dr. Jameson that reinforcements in wagons carrying more ammunition and what food could be spared were being sent to Shiloh. There, Forbes reorganized his force. The new provisions were sufficient to provide three-quarter rations for 300 men for 12 days, and to see the disaffected section back to Bulawayo. Forbes composed his new force of Captain Barrow and 22 men of the Salisbury Horse, Major Wilson and 70 mounted and 100 dismounted men of the Victoria Column, Captain Rauf and 20 men of the Rangers, and Captain Coventry with 78 men of the Bechuanaland Border Police. Soon after leaving Shiloh, the scouts found Lobengula's wagon tracks and followed them for 8 miles through thick bush. There were other signs that they were hot on the trail. Campfires whose ashes were still hot, pots and calabashes hastily abandoned, the charred remains of two of the king's wagons which had broken down and been destroyed. It was evident that Lobengula and his warriors were making for the Shangani River. The further they went, the more difficult conditions became. The whites were drenched by storm after storm, and the veldt became so waterlogged that the oxen pulling the wagons carrying their provisions gave up the struggle and collapsed. Forbes decided that the wagons were a hindrance. Forming a flying column of 160 men, he sent the rest with the wagons to a place called Umlangeni to await their return. The flying column pushed ahead with greater speed. On the evening of November the 30th, Johann Kolenbrander, who had been scouting, brought in an Induna he had known when he lived at the King's Kraal. By the way, an Induna is a minor tribal chief. The Induna said the Matabele had become dispirited through defeat, starvation, exposure to constant rain, and the ravages of smallpox, and most of them wanted to surrender. But the remnants of three of Lobengula's best regiments, the Insukameni, the Ilati, and the Siseba, were still loyal to the king and were covering his retreat. On December the 3rd, the column reached the bank of the Shangani River. They were very close on the king's heels now. Across the river, they could see a number of natives frantically driving the last of their cattle in the wake of an impi. They had evidently only just crossed, for on the column's side was evidence of a Matabele encampment with the fires still smoldering. But had the king himself crossed the river, or had he gone further along the bank? It was essential to know. Forbes decided to form a laager. By the way, that's a kind of fortress made out of circled wagons. Forbes decided to form a laager on open ground about 200 yards back from the river, while a small patrol went across the river to reconnoiter the further bank. He selected Major Alan Wilson, commander of the Victoria Column, to lead a patrol of 12 men. When Wilson and his men had disappeared into the bush on the other side, Forbes interrogated a captured native. From him, he learned that Lobengula was ill, and that with him were some 3,000 warriors from different regiments who were determined that he should not be taken prisoner. If reports that the Matabele morale was low were correct, Forbes planned to make a rush the next day, capture the king, and at once turn back for Bulawayo. They had now been out for 9 days. Their rations were dwindling, and if they were to get back to their wagons and food supplies in time, they would have to move swiftly. He expected Wilson and his men to return in a couple of hours, but the afternoon wore on, and darkness came without a sign of the missing patrol. In the meantime, Forbes had received a report that the bulk of Lobengula's warriors, under his chief Induna, Majan, had turned back and intended to attack the column that night. It was a dark night, and rain fell at intervals. About 9 o'clock, an alert picket heard the sound of horses and aroused the logger. Two men rode in who told Forbes that the patrol had followed Lobengula's wagon spoor for some 5 miles, and that Wilson considered the prospects of capturing the king were so good he had decided not to return that night. He wanted Forbes to send more men and a Maxim in the morning. 2 hours later, Captain Napier and two troopers reached the logger and reported that the patrol had got close to the bush enclosure protecting the king and his wagon, but had had to retreat to prevent themselves from being surrounded, and had taken up a position in the bush to wait for daylight. On neither occasion did Wilson state exactly what he wanted, although Napier said he thought he expected the rest of the column to cross the river and join him so that they could make a daylight raid on the enclosure at dawn. This Forbes refused to do. He expected a Matabele attack on his position, and he could not endanger his whole force by crossing the river in darkness, cutting off his retreat, and presenting his back to the enemy. He did not want to recall Wilson, since he was obviously in a good position to capture Lobengula, and if this opportunity were lost, it would never recur. He compromised by sending Captain Barrow and 20 men to reinforce the patrol, and thus made his mistake. The patrol was now too large to be merely a reconnoitering force, and too small for the dangerous task of trying to capture the king in defiance of the Matabele impis. But it strengthened Wilson's resolve to undertake his suicidal mission. At daybreak, Wilson and his 32 men approached Lobengula's enclosure. The wagon was still there, but when Wilson called on the king to surrender, there was no answer. In the ominous silence, they realized that during the night he had continued his flight. All hope of capturing him had gone. Then came the development that they had all been expecting and dreading. In the half-light, they heard the clicking of rifle bolts, and from behind a tree stepped a warrior wearing the Induna's head ring. He fired his rifle. This was the signal for a scattered volley, which intensified as more warriors came running through the bush. Most of the shots went over their heads, but two horses went down. A trooper, Dillon, ran to them, cut off the saddle pockets carrying ammunition, and regained his horse as Wilson gave the order to retreat to an ant heap, behind which they had sheltered the previous night. They reached it without losing a man. As horses were shot down, their riders jumped up behind men still mounted or ran alongside holding the stirrup irons. The volume of Matabele fire steadily increased, and the exposed position of the ant heap became untenable. Wilson ordered a retirement into the trees. And as they went, the rearguard, firing with cool accuracy, kept the Matabele at bay. But the Matabele were in no hurry. They had the white men at their mercy and could take their time. Several men had been wounded, and a number of them were dismounted. Wilson grouped these in the center and started off slowly for the river in the hope that some at least might reach the main column. For nearly a mile they marched without harm, their progress dogged by warriors keeping pace among the trees. Then they saw that their path was barred by a line of warriors waiting for them to come closer. An attempt to break through that barrier would mean sacrificing the wounded. That was unthinkable. They would face it together. Three men, however, got away. An American and two Australians galloped unscathed through the Matabele line, threw off their pursuers by doubling on their tracks, and reached the bank of the Shangani in safety. Shortly after leaving the patrol, they heard heavy firing and the shouting of hundreds of warriors as they attacked Wilson and his men. When they reached the river, they saw that there was no hope whatever for the patrol. Heavy rains upstream had swollen the waters of the river, and now it was in flood and rising every minute. They managed to get across only with the greatest difficulty. The subsequent fate of the Wilson patrol, whose bones now rest beneath their memorial on the Matopo Hill, on which Cecil Rhodes lies buried, was gathered afterwards from Matabele sources. They had selected a clearing among the trees for their last stand, and some standing, some kneeling, poured a hot fire in all directions. The Matabele had the advantage of better cover and took time to aim accurately and make their shots tell. But so calmly and steadily did the patrol fight back that, in spite of the bush and the trees, they took a heavy toll of the enemy. At one stage in the fight, said the Matabele, they had offered the white men their lives, provided they laid down their arms and surrendered. Their offer was scornfully rejected. There would be no surrender. The patrol used their dead horses as cover, but their numbers steadily dwindled. Many were killed outright, and the wounded went on fighting until they lost consciousness. The fight went on until late in the afternoon. Just before the end, the few surviving white men staggered to their feet, sang a few bars of God Save the Queen, shook hands with each other, and waited for the end. It was not long in coming. The Matabele charged them with their assegais and gave no quarter. One last man escaped for a few precious minutes, gained the top of an anthill a few yards away, and shot down several Matabele before a bullet smashed his hip. He was still firing a revolver as the assegais ended his life. There were no survivors. No one knew of their fate until 2 months later, when James Dawson, the trader, was led to the spot by a party of natives and found their skeletons. The trees all around were scored by bullet marks. The Matabele spoke of them reverently, and had been so impressed by their bravery that they had refrained from mutilating their bodies and had left them where they fell. Dawson dug a large grave and gave them temporary burial, close to a tree on which he cut a cross, and the words, "To brave men." In 1904, they were removed to the Matopos, to the hilltop consecrated and set apart forever for those who had deserved well of their country. Dr. Jameson paid Alan Wilson a tribute when he reported officially on the Shangani episode, and I quote, "Major Alan Wilson was one of the most gifted leaders of men I have met. personally brave to rashness, yet extremely careful and considerate of the men under his command, it followed that the men would go anywhere with him. It is to this hero worship of Wilson, so well deserved, that I attribute the large number of officers who accompanied him on that last fatal reconnaissance.
Here's a story of Rhodesia, a land both fair and great. On the 11th of November, an independent state. This was much against the wishes of certain governments, whose leaders tried to break us down and make us all repent. But we're all Rhodesians and we'll fight through thick and thin. We'll keep our land a free land from the enemy coming in. We'll keep them north of the Zambezi to let rivers run and dry. And this mighty land will prosper, for Rhodesians never die. They can send their men to murder, they can shout their words of hate, but the cost of keeping this land free can never be too great. 'Cause our men and boys are fighting for the things that they hold dear, and this land and all its people will never disappear. 'Cause we're all Rhodesians and we'll fight through thick and thin. We'll keep our land a free land from the enemy coming in. We'll keep them north of the Zambezi to let rivers run and dry. And this mighty land will prosper, for Rhodesians never die. We'll preserve this little nation for our children's children too. Once you're a Rhodesian, no other land will do. We will stand tall in the sunshine with the truth upon our sides. And if we have to go alone, we'll go alone with pride. 'Cause we're all Rhodesians and we'll fight through thick and thin. We'll keep our land a free land from the enemy coming in. We'll keep them north of the Zambezi till their rivers running dry. And this mighty land will prosper, for Rhodesians never die. 'Cause we're all Rhodesians and we'll fight through thick and thin. We'll keep our land a free land from the enemy coming in. We'll keep them north of the Zambezi till their rivers running dry. And this mighty land will prosper, for Rhodesians never die.
Well, our time is up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.